Welcome to the Penn Faulkner Podcast. I'm Nate Brown, Deputy Director of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. In episode 19, we bring you short readings by authors who participated in our Summer Supper and Book Club. Most people who know of Penn Faulkner are aware of our awards programming, including the Penn Malamud Award for Short Fiction and the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. What you might not know, though, is that since 1989, Penn Faulkner has run an extensive Writers in Schools program in Washington, D.C. that we've also recently expanded to Baltimore. As part of Writers in Schools, we also run a summer program, and this year, we call it the Penn Faulkner Summer Supper and Book Club. Over pizza or sub sandwiches, students discussed books they'd read by D.C. authors, and each week, an author whose work the students had read came in to dine and discuss their work with students. This year, we were lucky to have authors Susan Richard Shreve, a novelist and professor at George Mason University, Danielle Evans, a fiction writer and professor at American University, David A. Taylor, who writes both fiction and nonfiction, Felicia Pride, a novelist, essayist, and new media strategist, Derek Weston Brown, a poet, reading series coordinator, and bookseller at Busboys and Poets, and David Ebenbach, a fiction writer who teaches creative writing at Georgetown University. A quick note that due to a recording problem, we couldn't record David A. Taylor, so you won't hear him in this podcast episode, unfortunately. The episode begins with a short reading by Susan Richard Shreve from her novel, Plum and Jaggers.
And also, I should just say very quickly, it's very much the way I write. I write in short takes. Sam McWilliams was the only member of Plum and Jaggers who remembered the afternoon of June 11th when the first two cars of the Espresso from Milan to Rome exploded, killing everyone on board except for a four-year-old French boy and a conductor. Sam remembered exactly. He was 7 years old, 8 in November. Julia was too young for memory, sleeping in Sam's arms where their mother had put her when she left. You take Julia's shoe fly and I'll go help your father get lunch. I would like tea, Charlotte said, looking up from her book, and four cookies. I'd like a chocolate milkshake, Oliver had said. There are no chocolate milkshakes in Italy, their father said. I want one anyway, Oliver said pleasantly. Then I'll bring one, their father said. Had he returned with a late lunch, he might have bought tea instead of milk or mineral water. Here's your chocolate milkshake, Oliver, he would have said. Thank you, guys. You are a great group. I hope you have a good time this summer.
Next up, we have Danielle Evans reading her story Snakes from her story collection, Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self.
So I'm going to read to you part of Snakes. So since you guys have already read the story, I get to read from the middle, which is always fun, because ordinarily I have to read from the beginning. So I'm going to start from the bottom of page 39. A month into the summer, my grandmother had a brainstorm. She sat us down in the family room after dinner one night and told us that we absolutely must stop disobeying her and running off, that she'd become very worried about us, and that the next time we disappeared, she'd have no choice but to call the police. We nodded our assent, but were doubtful. Our grandmother had worried about what the neighbors would think when the gardener took a week off and dandelions had sprouted in her yard. We could only imagine what she'd do if people spotted a police car in her driveway. Sensing our skepticism, she leaned forward in her chair, looking first at me and then Allison in the eyes. Do you know what's living in that lake? Our grandmother asked. I thought we did. Minnows, tadpoles, mosquitoes we regularly slapped off of ourselves. Snakes, said my grandmother, snakes are in that lake. I giggled. We'd seen the occasional small brown garden snake. My mother had told me before she left that there were a lot of them where she grew up, and I shouldn't be alarmed, because they were perfectly harmless. I repeated this to my grandmother. Tell your mother, said my grandmother, that when you leave a place for 20 years, a lot changes. They've got these pythons that love water. Some idiots imported them as pets, and now they're taking over. A Burmese python can grow to be the size of the both of you put together and can get you from 20 feet away. Sometimes they lay eggs in drain pipes, and the baby python will travel through the sewer pipes and come right in through a hole in the wall and eat their prey alive. When a python eats something, it eats everything, even the bones, crushes them completely. Lately, there have been a lot of cats and dogs lost, even a huge St. Bernard vanished. I'd hate to lose a granddaughter. There'd be nothing left of you to find. Tell your mother she has never had any idea how easy it is for something to be destroyed. 2 weeks after that, I fell out of a bunk bed. My grandmother, sensing she'd gotten to me, had begun elaborating on the latest exploits of the Burmese python after dinner every night. A Burmese python had been caught in a child's bedroom in Orlando. A Burmese python had eaten an alligator in Lake Jackson. A tourist had gotten a picture of it happening before he ran. A Burmese python came out of the pipes in a Miami kitchen. A plumber only narrowly escaped with his life, and only because he was too fat for the snake to get his jaws around. 3 cats were missing from the house at the end of the block. They'd gone out in the morning as usual and simply never come back. I consulted the books my parents had left me, contemplating metallurgy and purification rituals as forms of protection. Actually undertaking any of them was impossible, especially when I refused to leave the house. It wasn't just the outside world I was nearly afraid of. I was haunted by what my grandmother had said about baby pythons, and imagined one growing and swelling inside the walls even now. My grandmother had won one battle. I stayed where she could see me, I tracked no more mud into her house, but she hadn't bargained for the way the fear would overtake me. I was afraid of snakes, yes, but I was also afraid of open windows, peeling paint, creaking floorboards, sinks, bathtubs, and toilets. I dropped the talisman I'd made out of plastic wings and chewing gum down an open shower drain while trying to wash myself and hold it under the faucet at the same time. I refused to pee unless Allison held my hand, panicked when within 10 feet of a wall, and tried my best not to sleep at night. One night, while trying to keep my body as far from the bedroom wall as possible, I fell from the top bunk. I hit my head, hard enough that it smacked sharply against the bare floor, and Allison woke up screaming at the sound. By the time my grandmother rushed into the room to see what had happened, Allison had already climbed out of the bottom bunk to sit beside me. My grandmother ran for her first, and I told myself, without believing it, that it was because she was the one who had screamed. Allison extracted herself from my grandmother's arms. Tara fell, she shrieked. She fell off the top of the bed. Are you hurt? My grandmother asked. I hit my head. My grandmother pressed a palm to my forehead. You're not cut, she said. Are you dizzy? I shook my head no. Don't move your head, said Allison, who had come by her medical knowledge through frequent viewings of her mother's favorite soap opera. Grandma, she could have a concussion. The bed is 5 feet high, said my grandmother. No one has a concussion. And if I take you to the hospital to find that out officially, they need to shave all those knots at the back of your head to see your scalp. Go to bed, both of you. Come get me if you feel funny. I didn't want to go back to bed. I thought briefly that if I went to the hospital, my parents might be called, and upon hearing that the house had been overtaken by enormous pythons, come and get me out of here, and maybe Allison too. But it was possible that no one would reach my parents. In any case, I believed my grandmother about the head shaving, and I didn't want to be bald. I stayed on the floor thinking that the ground was a good safe distance from the walls and whatever might be inhabiting them. Allison's voice rescued me from the embarrassment of admitting I was afraid to get back into my bed. I think, she announced with the authoritative wisdom of someone 6 months older, you have a concussion. You shouldn't move. I'm going to sleep next to you so I can check your breathing. She pulled the blue blanket off the bottom bunk and brought it to me. We curled up in the center of the floor, counting our rest in whispers until they came almost in unison. I opened my eyes every few minutes to check the walls for any sign of movement and check that Allison was still there. Every fourth or fifth time, I'd find Allison staring back at me, her 2 small fingers reaching out to feel the pulse on my neck. By the next morning, I was jumpy again. I kept up my new rituals, persisted in refusing to go outside. Nightly, Allison persuaded me into our bedroom, letting me sleep in the bottom bunk with her. When I refused to even do that, she'd sleep beside me on the floor. I spent most of my days in the center of the living room. Among its advantages were a wall consisting almost entirely of plate glass windows, meaning there was one less direction from which I could be ambushed, and a wall of portraits that, once I'd read through the last of the books my parents had sent me with, I began to study in earnest in order to keep myself entertained. There, with my grandmother's whole life in gilded frames, the family together, my grandmother younger and undeniably beautiful, the grandfather I had never met, pictures of my uncles as kids, their hair pressed down so flat it looked like they'd been wearing helmets before the pictures were taken. Uncle Mark and Uncle Timothy at high school and then college graduations. Wedding portraits, including one of Allison's father marrying his first wife. At the one Christmas dinner we'd spent together, my grandmother announced the first wife was a better woman than Allison's mother would ever be. Allison had run from the room in tears. Everyone else sat there like they hadn't heard her. My mother said that later that if they'd all stopped eating every time my grandmother said something honest but awful, they would have starved to death before they were 10. There were no pictures of my mother's wedding on my grandmother's wall. The pictures of her stopped at 16. There was my mother, wispy and young-looking, eyes wide open and surprised. I imagined her daydreaming before the photo was snapped. It wasn't long after that when my mother took off on a road trip across the country with friends who imagined themselves hippies. Some of these people were still my mother's friends, and in one of their houses I had seen pictures from that summer, my mother laughing and making faces in the back seat, my mother sleeping on a beach somewhere. My mother didn't talk about that summer. While she was off with her friends, my grandfather was killed when his small plane encountered a tropical storm and crashed. In my grandmother's butterfly theory, my mother was the moth who flapped her wings in Japan and caused disaster. There was an inevitable correlation between her being in the wrong place at the wrong time and my grandfather's untimely accident. I had been given this secret knowledge too early to know what to do with it. I was old enough to know better than to prod my mother with questions, but too young to understand debt and obligation, too young to understand what my mother must have felt during her mother's fight with cancer, or to appreciate the uncertainty my grandmother must have been living with. I was too young to understand that a python could be not just a threat but a warning, and too young to understand why this summer, of all summers, I had been sent off as a flawed peace offering. Allison got impatient with my refusal to leave the room. She tried to reason with me. If a snake wanted to eat us, wouldn't it have done it already? If a starving python was living in our lake, wouldn't all the other animals be dead by now? I wanted to believe her, but then I pictured myself being crushed into fine dust inside of something so big that no one could hear me scream, vanishing without my parents ever knowing what had happened. When logic failed, Allison retrieved my copy of Natural Wonders of the Amazon Rainforest from where it lay abandoned and pointed out pictures of snake after snake. Look, she said, pointing at a picture of a man with a large yellow snake wrapped around his shoulders, two women in the background looking unfazed. All these people who live with snakes, and they haven't been eaten. Your parents are with these snakes right now, and they're not dead. How do you know? I asked. They told me before leaving that by a month into the summer they would be unreachable, leaving Rio for the dense territory of the rainforest, a place where they neither sent nor received letters. Allison gave up on me after that. She stopped letting me sleep on the bottom bunk. She began to tease me about my fears. I made a new amulet out of one of Allison's barrettes and a friendship bracelet she had given me. Allison demanded the barrette back, and when I refused, ripped the bracelet in half. My phobia was taking a greater toll on her than boredom. Being inside meant she had to spend more time in the direct presence of my grandmother. My grandmother quizzed Allison incessantly about her grades, pulled her into the study to review brochures for day school she wanted Allison to be prepared to apply to next summer. Allison's credentials sorely disappointed her. Makeup theft and an active imagination were apparently not among the early markers of genius. Her grades were not great, and her school records were dotted with minor citation. Allison talked back to teachers. Allison poured glue in someone's hair. Allison stole the class turtle to keep as a pet. When I overheard my grandmother grilling Allison about these infractions, I shimmered with a kind of pride in her boldness, but Allison's explanations were alarmingly meek. Even my grandmother noticed that Allison seemed to get in some sort of trouble every time her parents left for a vacation, which they did often, year-round, but Allison refused to admit to the correlation. My grandmother scheduled Allison for beginning piano lessons and took her for informal conversations with a French-speaking neighbor. My grandmother didn't invite me to come, which saved me the trouble of refusing to leave with her. In any case, she wouldn't have had grounds to force me. My mother shared her views on language and music, if not her approach. I attended bilingual elementary school and was in the school orchestra. Had she asked, my grandmother would have found out that I spoke fluent Spanish and played the viola quite nicely. There was a long time that I didn't talk about that summer at all, and then there were times when it was all I could talk about. It was the sort of thing that made a person interesting in college, my youth as a real-life tragic mulatta. My recovery turned my scars into party favors. If you had seen them, the dot on my leg, the line on my elbow, the water in my eyes when I talked about Allison, then you had something about me to take with you. If you knew what was behind it, you had even more. If you think your family was messed up, people would whisper, you should talk to that girl. In my first year of law school, I was famous for using myself as the basis for a sample torts question in study group. People wondered whether being so casual about it meant that I was screwed up or that I was okay. I couldn't have answered them. A confession, because I didn't know the difference between kinds of intimacy back then, I told each of the first four men I slept with that he was the only one I'd ever told this story. Jason was the fourth and the only one to call me a liar. He'd already heard the story from my roommate the week before. According to him, it was part of what had made him like me in the first place. I was so stunned that I kicked him out of bed and didn't speak to him again for months. But after he had left and I'd given up trying to sleep, I wondered which part of the story had drawn him to me. I never asked, but I wondered. I wondered years later when he called the Yale Housing Law Clinic on behalf of the New Haven Register and, upon recognizing my name and voice at the other end of the line, asked me to dinner. I wondered, it was a tiny flash in the back of my mind, but yes, I wondered, when he brought me takeout during finals week at the end of my second year of law school and I cracked open the fortune cookie and found an engagement ring. Was it the part of the story where I was strong that made me special or the part where I was weak? It mattered more than I could say.
Next, we have author Felicia Pride reading from her novel, Patterson Heights.
Okay, so I'll begin with from the prologue, Time's Out. Time is funny, not ha-ha funny like those silly comedians who come on late night cable. Time is funny, like funny acting. It'll switch up on you like a friend who steals your girl. One minute you're a little kid copping candy at the corner store with your big brother. The next minute you're at his funeral wondering if tears run out. That's why I've lost respect for time. I used to count the number of minutes that my people spent arguing in the next room. How often moms yelled at pops for the wildest reasons. Because he failed to call her when he was supposed to. Or he left his socks in the middle of the living room floor. Or because he wouldn't get out the car to pay respects to his dead son. But I've lost count. Or lost the desire to count. Not sure which one. It didn't take me long to realize that the time my parents wasted being mad at each other didn't mean spit. 5 minutes versus 15, no difference. A fight is a fight regardless of how long it lasts. Death is permanent no matter if it happened yesterday or if it took place a year ago. That realization came to me the hard way. Time is funny. It'll flip on you. One minute you're part of the perfect family, or at least the family that's perfect for you. Mine didn't have tons of money, didn't live in one of those big houses in the county, but we had each other and that was enough for me. But in a matter of seconds, that unit was smashed into unidentifiable pieces. My family, as I once knew it, no longer exists. That's time for you. You can say that time and I are beefing, hard. If I could, I'd grab seconds, minutes, and hours by the neck and force them to follow my lead, do what I told them to do. I'd blast time in its back and force it to erase itself. I'm tired of time kicking my butt up and down life. In between blocking out the yells of my parents and thinking about the downward spiral of my life, the death of the family I once knew, the constant threats to my budding manhood, and the girl who's got my mind doing backflips, I've come up with a master plan. I'm going to steal time away from time. I'm going to start over. Forget the fact that I spent the last 15 years in a life that I can no longer recognize. If the people who own those talk shows with messed up lives can put the past behind them and start new, I figure so can I. Same name, same parents, different Avery Washington. I might not be able to completely erase time, but I can put a serious dent in its plans. It's like a rebirth. But honestly, I don't care what you call it. All that matters is that things are going to be different. Life, my life, will be different.
Next up, we have a story from author David Ebenbach.
This is a story that I hope will be in my next book. That's the idea. And it's called Our Mothers Left Us. Our mothers left us. They left all at once. There was no warning or none that we could read. We were only children, and our fathers were only their helpless selves. One minute our mothers were near us, making the noises of pots and pans in the kitchen, or they were sitting talking with cousins at the family barbecue, or they were arguing with us about the mess we'd made, or they said they were just taking a quick nap, or they were walking with us through the bright clamor of the mall, and then the next minute they were gone. Our mothers were not in the kitchen, not in a lawn chair, not slamming doors, not in their bedrooms, not in any of the stores. Nobody had seen them. They couldn't be found by phone. Our mothers were nowhere at all. As we searched, dull with shock, we saw the spaces our mothers had inhabited were not just empty. They contained the presence of our mother's absence. We saw a shadow, a faint outline that matched the outline of what we knew and remembered. We heard the wind settling in like shallow breaths, heard a spot on the floor groan from what it had so recently held. What it still wanted to hold. The world lacked our mothers the way it lacked sun on miserable days, the way it lacked solace in the sharpest heat. It lacked them needfully, tangibly, in a way that you could almost, but couldn't quite hold. Our fathers threw themselves clumsily into our lives. They cooked haphazard dinners, told nervous jokes, bought us what we wanted, scolded us as well as they could. There was no way for them to succeed, but we all pretended that we got the light we needed from these distant stars. We smiled for them, and we knew then, too soon, what it was like to have others in our care. Some of us sat on the front stoop where the careening fireflies seemed stunned, and we allowed important certainties to drain out of us into the stone. What we did while we waited could be called growing up. Even with puberty lagging, we became adults in other ways. We understood that the world had never told us that things were under control, that we had believed that because we had needed to believe that. Certainly our mothers had never said that, or never convincingly. Only our fathers had, and they had just been frightened of the truth. We berated ourselves. We had made it necessary for our mothers to teach us these painful lessons. It was hard to not look up from the stoop again and again in the expectation that our mothers would be coming down the street. We learned how a person refrains from looking, and we learned many times how you inevitably fail at that. We learned what our own feet look like when we're staring but too frightened to see them. And we learned the exact picture of the empty sidewalk on the block, where the trees leaned, where they held back, the way the front yards lapped up to the place where our mothers should have been but weren't. It was probably only a few hours. We couldn't be sure because eventually we slept. We allowed ourselves tears when we were alone in our dark rooms and our fathers were watching television as though hunting for a message. And then, to our lasting shame, with the sound of the disinterested television in our ears, we fell dead into sleep. We would go on to hate ourselves for this, and we would blame many things to come on our weakness. When we woke up, our mothers were back. They stood in the doorways of our bedrooms, emerging from shadow. We leapt, clung to them as though we were still children, and for a time we believed it. But we stopped believing when our mothers gently put us back at arm's length, wondering at our affection, claiming to have never been gone at all. They stood up and told us to get ready for the day, and we watched them turn to leave the room, and before that could happen, we threw out our arms and held on. We knew the bargain that was asked of us, and we would, by necessity, replace childhood with a desperate attention, an idolatrous certainty that our mothers would never leave us again if we only did exactly what we needed to do to keep them. The new day rolled on, and at times it was as though nothing had happened. The sky lit up and covered our families. Our fathers laughed and kept things happy. Our mothers returned to kitchens and chairs and hallway arguments and all the other stations of their lives to the extent that we understood those lives at all. We would endeavor for the rest of our lives to understand them. On this day in particular, we were perfect. We sang, we danced, we carried dishes without breaking any. We kept the bargain. Of course, that didn't prevent it from happening again. Of course, our mothers would leave again, without warning, and many times. Certainly mine did. Thank you.
We're going to end the episode with a few poems by Derek Weston Brown, which he read for me actually a couple of weeks after his visit with the Summer Supper and Book Club over at the Busboys and Poets at 14th and V here in Washington, D.C.
Hello, my name is Derek Weston Brown. This is a poem called Miss Train. It's one of my D.C. poems out of my series of D.C. poems from my book Wisdom Teeth. Miss Train. I smelled you at the metro stop, tasted you on the yellow, glimpsed you on the green, caught you on the orange, loved you on the red, lost you on the blue. Now, I need a transfer, or at least exit fare, because no one deserves to take such a ride and end up being taken for every dime. Baby, you a last minute change of plans, an unexpected phone call at the God hour that leaves me feeling mortal. So, this next piece is dedicated to hip-hop and also dedicated to one of my favorite hip-hop groups, A Tribe Called Quest. And they have a particular song about this particular mythical woman called Bonita Applebaum. And this is my poem dedicated to hip-hop and Bonita. Remembering Bonita Applebaum. Bonita Applebaum be an onyx-colored Milky Way-sprinkled infinity loop of a goddess's laugh. Bonita Applebaum be the pentatonic scale squeezed into form-fitting denim overalls. Bonita Applebaum be Coltrane's Naima at 88 beats per minute, riding an Ali Shaheed Muhammad breakbeat, bareback. Bonita Applebaum be your daddy's woman before your mama came into the picture. Bonita Applebaum be leaving thugs breathless, their eyes leaking water from nostalgia. Bonita Applebaum's eyes shiny like new vinyl, fresh like a Rudy Huxtable perm. Bonita Applebaum be your first back porch, summer sunset, French kiss, first pack of Knock Chopper incense, first hip-hop sample that makes you seek out the source. Bonita Applebaum be 1989, baby dreads, salt fish, ginger beer, sweet iced tea, cassava, cola champagne, mud cloth, head wraps, ashy knees, shea butter, library cards, bottled water, and rickety first-time ancestor shrines. Bonita Applebaum be black folks in Birkenstocks, and that's okay. Bonita Applebaum's bookshelf is bigger than yours, so what you gonna do about it? Bonita Applebaum be a dog-eared copy of erotic noir. Bonita Applebaum be light-skinned girl crushes on Lisa Bonet, Jasmine Guy, Pebbles, and Tisha Campbell from House Party. Bonita Applebaum be dark-skinned girl crushes on Cheryl Lee Ralph, Eddie Murphy's first wife from Coming to America, and Karen White. Bonita Applebaum still knows the lyrics to every song on Eric B. and Rakim's Paid in Full album. Bonita Applebaum be your first on-purpose poke on the dance floor. Bonita Applebaum be the reason you got a Sankofa tattoo on your left shoulder blade. Bonita Applebaum be the rasp of Q-Tip's voice that puts goosebumps on your girl's neck even now. Bonita Applebaum ain't 38, 24, 37, no more. Bonita Applebaum be 33 with a mortgage and 2 degrees under her belt. Your mama still asks about Bonita, Bonita, Bonita. Bonita Applebaum be your son's second grade teacher, guidance counselor, Spanish tutor. Bonita Applebaum drives a Toyota 4Runner, the hybrid model with mud cloth seat covers. Bonita Applebaum is still slamming like a hip-hop song. So that's for Miss Bonita Applebaum, always a mythical and wonderful. Hopefully one day I thought she'd be real, but you know, but there are plenty of Bonitas out there. So this next poem came from a prompt called Write About a Time When You Weren't the Hero. And so, this poem is called The Forgiveness Poem. Forgiveness Poem, after Randall Horton. Alicia Turnbull didn't do anything but breathe and be a girl. It was her skin we didn't like. This was back then when to be a dark skin was to be a punchline. Hey, Alicia, you so black when they called your name at night school and you said here, they still marked you absent. Hey, Alicia, you so black you leave fingerprints on charcoal. Alicia Turnbull didn't do nothing but be. Be a girl, be a sister, be the darkest child in her family, in her class, and after school. We tore her down daily. What a smile, we smashed it. What a laugh, we choked it. She cried every day, fought the older girls who called her names, smacked her upside the head and claimed they still couldn't knock the black off. I was the nice one, but I pitched in too the day she tried to sit next to me at the swimming pool. My friends started hollering, and I turned to her and said, "Don't nobody want to sit by your old ugly black self?" Alicia Turnbull didn't do anything but breathe, be a girl, a sister, a daughter. We made her a shadow, stole her light till she disappeared. Forgive me, Alicia, for not seeing your beauty and believing the perm kit, TV, fading cream whispers that said our brown, cocoa, red-tinged blackberry hues were injury to insult. Forgive me for believing that night held no glory today. Forgive me for holding whitewashed fairy tales as truth. Forgive my ugliness and my dark heart. Wherever you are, Alicia, forgive me. So maybe someday that poem may actually reach her. That'd be a wonderful thing if it did, but I would say that poem at least gave me some solace in, you know, what I did at that young age. So I don't know, I think we'll take a depart from stuff from the book, and I have a newer poem, and it's a love poem for my significant other. So just as soon as I can, I'm gonna read it. I'm trying this online thing where you have like your YouTube stuff for your stuff on Facebook, and so I'm looking on my phone to try to look it up, and here it is. And it's called Love Poem on a Not So Great Day for Joy. And the poem opens with an epigraph, a quote from one of my favorite artists, Sade, from her song Kiss of Life. And the epigraph is, "Look at the sky, it's the color of love." Excuse me. Love for him on a not so great day. All right, just so you know, you ain't slick. When you called me today, I was all too ready to thump your eardrums with attitude because today hadn't been the best day. And I called you at our designated time, 12:30-ish, and all I got was an automated absence and a beep, and I wasn't trying to hear that. I was wearing disappointment tight around me like a shrunken shirt, half Nelson by every little mishap and mistake of the day. Did I also mention there was this halo of a headache orbiting my sorry excuse of a skull, and that I know it's my fault because I didn't drink enough water like I'm supposed to, and breakfast this morning, meh. Oh, and the sky was threatening to rain, and my car was growling like I just tied a saddle to a Kodiak Grizzly and dug my spurs in. So when I felt my phone hum to life in my pocket and I spied your blinking silhouette and name on my touchscreen, I was ready to spill my melodrama into your waiting ears. And what do you say when I a hello into the receiver? Hey, boo. And then you laugh that wind chime of a laugh into my ear and I'm done. And I chuckle up all the salt and vinegar and scarecrow sag against a waiting wall. Oh man, you see, I was all ready to drop this attitude on you, and here you go with all this hey boo stuff. And I can't even get mad. Can't even stoke those cooled coals from earlier. The smile I have won't leave. Even as I tried to vent through all our dueling giggles and snickers, I tell you that I'm a blues walking, that I'm ornery and bored, and that nothing seems to excite me anymore. And you say, fool. That's what I'm for. And boom, we're back laughing. And I'm nodding, yes. And I'm marveling at how you always seem so close, even though you're 6 hours away. And even now, through the laughter, I wonder how we've been able to do this at a distance, or how you transport sunsets and shoulder slopes and traces of nature's blessing in coconut oil through 1,000 miles of fiber optical satellite rays, and how you transcend bad days and hug me through drop calls and downpours and doubt and damn. Look at the sky. It's the color of love.
We'd like to thank all of the authors who participated in the Summer Supper and Book Club. We'd also like to thank you for listening to this episode of the Penfocker Podcast. Thanks too to Amazon.com for making the recording and production of this podcast possible, and to Benedict Kupstas, who composed the music that you heard in this episode. You and your organization can help support Pen Faulkner by helping to underwrite our reading series. To hear more about underwriting opportunities, please give me a call at 202-898-9063 or check us out on the web at www.penfaulkner.org. The next episode of the Pen Faulkner Podcast will be episode 20, and it features author M.K. Asante, author of the new memoir Buck, in conversation with writer and professor Lisa Page. It's a great episode, and it should be out in about a week, so check that out the first week of October, and we will see you next time at the Pen Faulkner Podcast.